You're listening to the London Buddha Centre, talks and seminars from our home in Bethnal Green, exploring Buddhism in a way that is relevant to contemporary life.
So yes, it's a tradition at the centre that at the beginning of the year, near the beginning of the year, the chair launches the year with a theme. So I'm going to continue that tradition this year. And 2016, I think it was, Nana Varcha, who's sitting right there at the back, sort of set us off on a theme. So I'm continuing that tonight. So 2016, he launched the theme called, or the teaching of the four Sangravastus. So the four Sangravastus are really how the ways or means a bodhisattva, which is a spiritually advanced being, a bodhisattva sets about creating or unifying or strengthening or developing sangha. So that's the four Sangravastus. So in 2016, Jnanavacha launched the first of these qualities. There's four of them. The first one is dana, generosity. And then the following year was loving, kindly speech. Last year, in his last year as chair, he spoke about beneficial activity. And tonight I'm going to do the final quality, which is exemplification. So it's been a very significant year, the last he launched that for me personally, because I took over from him, as Subhadramati said, but also for this centre. We had our 40th, we launched our 40th anniversary in October, the 30th of October. So that was very significant for us, and we had a month-long celebration. And the 31st of October, the next day, Bhante Sangharakshita died. So he's the founder of this movement. So that was very significant for us here, but the whole of Triratna. And of course, the world has been doing its thing all that time as well. There's a lot going on in the world. A few good things, but mostly things that seem very challenging to me. So a lot of change there's been a lot of change, basically. So I wouldn't say I've been sort of consciously thinking of exemplification throughout that time, but certainly when I realised that was the final topic to cover, I was pleased. I thought, that's a good a theme to cover. And in a way, it's been something that's been at the back of my mind. And so it's a good opportunity to reflect on it with you. Before I speak about exemplification, I want to just mention, talk about spiritual community. So lovely to see so many of you here, firstly, and to know that there's people that have come for the very first time to this centre, and many of us have been practicing for many years. And I really like occasions like this where everybody comes together. So I'm just very pleased, firstly, to see all of you here. But the question occurred to me, why does a very spiritually advanced being, a bodhisattva, why do they want to create sangha? Why do they want to develop sangha? Why do they put their energy on that and not something else? Because really, a spiritually advanced being, they're somebody who's they've got enlightenment in their grasp, if you like. They can course in stages of bliss. They're free of concern. So why then put energy into creating a sangha? And I think that question that arose for me, because I remember when I first came along myself to the centre. It wasn't this centre, it was another one. And I learned all about meditation and what you could do. And I learned about the teachings and, you know, that you could actually be free through practising the teachings. And I was very attracted to that. And I loved hearing about the bliss that you can get into meditation. That sounded great to me. And I wanted that. I wanted to live a meaningful, worthwhile life, I wanted to be personally happy. I wanted to be free of worry and concern. So that's what attracted me. And in a way, that was mostly what was in my mind. If I think back then, that was mostly what I was concerned with. I sort of wanted personal freedom, personal liberation. But I also was aware that there's a world out there that was in trouble, was in difficulty. I was very aware of suffering in the world, and I also felt at times that I wanted to do something about that too. So I would sort of go between like, well, I just want to be happy. I've got enough to sort out in my own mind that really it's going to take all my energy to just look out for myself and transform myself. And then every now and again, I'd read the news or, you know, see something happening and just think, no, the world is in a terrible state. And also, what can I do about it? What can I do about the suffering that I see and hear about it? And it wasn't suffering. It wasn't an academic thing for me, because I knew that I had suffered through the world, if you like. You know, I had experiences of racism and poverty growing up. So the world would impinge itself, you know, on me as well. So I certainly, it wasn't an academic query I had, but I would swing between, you know what, you've just got to, don't be selfish. It'd be like, I wasn't surrogate to them, but it was like, don't be selfish. You've got to really think about others, and you really look at, you know, you can make a difference to others. So I'd swing between that and going, you know what, I've got enough on my plate. I've really just got to look out for myself. So I would, these would sort of, I would oscillate between the two things. So, and also in terms of social issues, I was just very aware that, okay, where does one start? You know, there were some particular areas that I was interested in, I feel I could make a difference in. And I could put all my energy into, say, I don't know, working with young people, for example. But then, you know, you look around and there's another social difficulty, social issue. And then you look around and there's another one. And it was like, even if you put all your energy into sorting out one area of life, there are myriad other problems, social problems. So I would definitely get caught up in this and not know what to do. So yes, the world here, the world, me here and the world there, and what was in between. Well, I think the answer to that question is, why does a bodhisattva, why do they put their energy into creating sangha? Well, firstly, I think it's a natural expression of an advanced spiritual being. But why they do that is because, well, the world needs a context where people can grow and develop and then influence the world, yeah? So in a way, sangha is a bridge between self and one's own individual quest, if you like, for freedom, for happiness, and the world. You can't change the world in an abstract way. People try, because we have people write constitutions. You know, I was in South Africa last year, and there was a lot of talk about the new constitution that had been produced post-apartheid, and people were putting a lot of store by the constitution. And it is important because it sets at least an ideal for the country. But then how do people live that day to day? That takes personal change as well as societal change. So sangha is a bridge between self, quest for our own happiness, and the world. So in a way, this community, in a way, firstly, it really is just firstly a positive group for us, that we can just learn about ourselves, get to know ourselves. Really, that's what I needed to do when I first came along. You know, there was lots about myself I didn't really understand. Where we can grow in confidence, where we can be valued and value others. But it does go beyond sort of that positive group. It really, the sangha, what propels the sangha is this vision of a world where everyone can live in harmony. So that sounds very easy to say, but actually that's a huge thing, to live in harmony. It doesn't mean, when we think about living in harmony, it doesn't mean we're sort of always aligned necessarily to each other. We are different to each other. We've got different backgrounds, different conditioning, etc. But it means that you can feel deeply connected to each other with all your differences, yeah? With all your differences. So the vision is a spiritual community is propelled by this vision where we can live in harmony, where we can actually learn to let go and transform our greed, hatred and delusion and all the things that keep us separate from each other. And we can be we can live not just in harmony, but we can live with generosity, we can live with clarity, we can live with warmth and connection, with fearlessness. It's a very big vision, actually. It's a vision of the Buddha when he became enlightened. He knew he could, through teaching, make a huge difference to the world. And that's what he set out to do. But it is a big vision, and because if you think about it, there's so much that separates us. We all have our very particular identification, whether that's gender, race, sexuality, status, income, geography, nationality. There's so many things that separate us and make us feel different to another. So to actually sort of get that sense of connection, deep interconnection is not an easy task, but the Buddha showed that it was possible. So what we need in the community is to sort of come together around the value of the possibility of that we can gradually through practice let go of our particular identification and move towards what we have in common. Really, that's what we're doing, which we're connecting with our common humanity and relating on that basis and gradually letting go of our particular things that are just very particular to us and moving into what is unique, what is common to us all. So I like to imagine sometimes, as a little exercise, what the world would be like if everyone did the Metta Bhavana. If I was going on the tube in the morning and everyone had done the Metta Bhavana before they got on the tube. And if there was any, because there's lots of us on the tube, especially in rush hour, if there was any sort of, a issue there, that we would remember the Metta Bhavana practice and we'd remember to be mindful. So I like to imagine that. And I like to imagine what it'd be like in a workplace, for example, where everyone was practicing mindfulness, ethics, and Metta Bhavana. Imagine your workplace. Or in a family situation where everyone was super ethical and honest and caring and kind. And when they weren't, they were able to say that. They were able to say, you know what, this is what's going on for me. I like to imagine that because I feel that it's possible. It might not be possible in my lifetime, but in a way I feel like I like to think that it's possible, and certainly I see that situations can be transformed bit by bit, little by little. Certainly I remember when I started meditating in my family, at first they were very resistant, and my mum was completely like freaked out as to what I was doing. But actually, over time, they all began to become curious and interested, and they sort of really respected what I was doing. And I certainly felt there was a different level of communication in my family, and one that I feel like I'm benefiting from today. There's a lot to say that there's not issues. Of course there are. They're not Buddhist. They're not practicing. But I can talk to them on the basis of what we have in common. And that's actually a very powerful thing to be able to do. Not on the basis of, well, you're my little sister, so really you should do what I say, which is, I think, is how it used to be. But on the basis of, I know that you want to be happy. I know you want to be free. I know that you also work with the things that I've had to work with. So when I was 9, 10 and 11, I got the opportunity to go to Holland for a month. It was a scheme. There's lots I can say about this scheme. It was a sort of a local council scheme to send kids from East London to Holland for a whole month. Can you imagine them doing that now? Age 9. And it was a proper proper Dutch family and Dutch context, in that, you know, it's the middle of the countryside. There were cows in the field, there's a windmill, there were clogs at the door, and they actually wore clogs. there was a sort of piano and, you know, in the lounge area. And I spent a month there for three consecutive years. And I remember on the last time I came back, I was walking down my street in East London, and I just stopped and looked around me and looked at the street. It was a very bit of a rough area. And I looked around me and I just thought, and it wasn't the first time I had this feeling, but it came very strongly, like, what am I doing here? And how did I get here? How did I get sort of in this family, in this street, firstly, you know, in this context, in this family, you know, in the body I'm in, you know, as, you know, as a black woman, as a black child, how did all that happen? And who am I? Who am I outside of those things? Because I realised, I thought, well, you could have been a girl in the Holland. I could have brought up in the countryside. I could have, you know, gotten used to playing the piano every day. I could have been looking at cows instead of looking at, you know, high rises. What would my experience been? My experience be if that was my situation? And would I feel internally the same way as I feel now? Would I have the similar thoughts and feelings? Really, I wanted to know, who am I beyond my conditions? My conditions were definitely impacting on me. I felt that just going to school every day. Going to school was quite a thing because there was always some level of violence really ready to, you know, erupt. So, you know, I sort of felt impacted by my environment. But I thought, if I wasn't having to deal with all of this, and even, you know, things that were going on in my family and all the rest of it, who would I be? You know, what would be, who would be this being? So I wanted to know who I was beyond the conditions that I was in. And I think that question really started me off on my search, actually. And I decided I should really find out more about how societies run. So I got involved in politics, and I got involved in social science and things like that, just to kind of see if I could understand the conditions, the particular conditions I was in. And it did help. It certainly helped me understand that. But it didn't get me any closer to that, okay, who am I beyond those conditions? Didn't get me closer to that question. So, in the spiritual community, in a way, to begin with, we're doing at least that two things. We're sort of coming into a context where we can, through meditation, through practice, through the teachings, actually learn about who we are, learn about our conditioning, you know, how things have impacted on us. And sometimes we find people with similar experiences to us, and that kind of really can really be illuminating. Sometimes we also find people vastly different to us. And that's also very illuminating, recognising that someone's had a completely different life and sees a world completely, radically different to us. And you think, oh, how did that happen? If you become a Mitra, as in to get a bit more involved and decide you're a Buddhist, we have Mitra study classes. And in my Mitra group, what's really interesting, we'll all study the same teaching, and we'll talk about it, but we'll all have very different views of this teaching. And we think, oh, it means this. And some say, no, it means this. And, you know, it means that. And it's really, I find that always, that's really fascinating to me, because then we, at some point, we have to go, well, okay, it's all valid. It's all interesting hearing about different people's interpretations of a teaching. It teaches us a lot about ourselves. It teaches us a lot about others. And at some point we think, okay, what does the teaching mean then? If you can have so many different sort of interpretations, what does the teaching actually mean? I find that a very interesting sort of exploration. Because we need to get truth, we need to get closer to the truth of the teaching that's not identified with our own particular conditions and conditioning. So I have to say it's taken me quite some time, I would say, to appreciate the spiritual community and the different ways how important it is, but also how it's impacted on me. It's taken me a while. I remember when I heard that the Buddha said that the Sangha, the spiritual community, was of equal importance to the Buddha and the Dharma. And I was like, really? I just couldn't quite see that. I thought, you have to have the Buddha. You have to have what the Buddha represents is the fullness of human potential. So you have to have the Buddha. The Dharma, that's the path, that's the teachings, whereby if we follow it, we get closer and closer to what the Buddha was talking about. And the Sangha, well, you need the Sangha, I guess. That was kind of my thing. Well, you need the Sangha, I guess, because someone's got to teach you the teachings. But I couldn't see it as equal, as important. And then when I almost fell off my chair when I heard that the Buddha said that spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. That was a very challenging teaching for me. Because in a way, I didn't sort of come along to make friends, actually. I really wanted to come along for my own sort of personal development. That's really why I came along. So I was very challenged by that teaching. But I did think, well, if the Buddha has said that, there's something in it. And I need to find that out for myself. And I'm very, very grateful that, that I did stay engaged. And, I have over time, in a way, it's an aspect that keeps giving, actually, the Sangha. It keeps giving in so many different ways. It was a challenge for me at the outset, and it was a conscious practice. I knew that I sort of really connected to the Buddha, I connected to the Dharma, I didn't quite connect to the Sangha in the same way, so I knew that that was something I had to work with in order to understand the Buddha and in order to understand the Dharma. So I did get more involved in order to do that. What really helped me quite early on was hearing about spiritually advanced practitioners. We have two on the shrine this evening. I went along, I was quite new actually, I'd only been involved a few months, but somebody told me to come along to this event that was happening at York Hall, and I wasn't living in London at the time. So I just thought, out of curiosity, I thought, well, let me just go and see, see what's happening. I'll pop in and then I'll go home. And they were celebrating the death anniversary of Dada Rinpoche, which is that first picture there. And firstly, even that concept of a death celebration was very new to me. Death and celebration didn't usually go together. So that was interesting, but it did feel like a celebration. I remember walking in and there were lots of colours everywhere, and there's lots of laughter, people were embracing each other, and just such a positive atmosphere. I think the most positive collective atmosphere I'd ever been in. I felt it immediately when I walked in. And then I met Bante there, Bante Sangwach, the founder, he was sort of comparing the event, and I really liked him. I'd already read one or two of his books, but in person he had this real wry sense of humour, and he was very sharp. That's what I liked. I thought he's got a very, you could tell, very clear, very strong intellect, and yet he spoke in a way that I can completely understand what he was saying. And also he had a lot of humour, and I really enjoyed the way he compared that occasion. And they were talking about Dada Rinpoche, and he was talking about Dada Rinpoche, and he called Dada Rinpoche a living bodhisattva. Someone who's intent on enlightenment for their own sake and for the sake of all beings. And he spoke about Dado's life, and many people spoke about meeting Dado for the first time, and many other order members and mitras. And the picture that I got was of a man who would spend hours meditating in the morning, and practicing and in the evening, and then through the rest of the day was very active. He had actually had a school for Tibetan orphans, and he'd be very engaged in looking after the children there and caring for them. He was also engaged in the local area and teaching people that came to see him. I got this sense of this man of, who had inexhaustible energy and kindness and care for all kinds of people, whoever they were. There was no sense of standing on ceremony or status. He just, so on some level, he was a very ordinary human being. But he really connected with so many different people. And it was the first time that I'd come across someone who was able to really care for many people and still have lots of energy and joy. Somehow for me, caring for many people meant getting worn out and getting a bit sort of, like the martyr sort of syndrome somehow. And there was none of that. There was joy, there was energy, there was connection. And I really loved hearing about him. So the combination of seeing Bante, this sort of very... he was certainly very, I could tell he was wise, I could tell he had a sense of humour, very clear communicator. And in hearing about Dada Rinpoche, Dada Rinpoche helped me make that connection between me here, my own individual quest, and the world. Began to help me see the connection there. And I remember walking home afterwards, I stayed to the end, it was raining outside and it was dark, and I felt like I was walking on clouds going home. It was a very wonderful evening. And I felt at that occasion that I was definitely a Buddhist. I thought, I'm definitely a Buddhist. And I wanted to, actually, I met somebody else there who actually was a woman who ordained me. I just remembered she was one of the speakers. And she spoke about her meeting with Dada Rinpoche. And there were lots of speakers that day, but she stood out for me. And I remember thinking, I'm going to get to know you. That I knew there was something about her that I wanted to learn. She had what I called at the time, in my mind, there was something about her that she had a real ethical sensibility. And I knew it was something that ethics didn't really particularly attract me, funnily enough. But I could see that, because I thought it was boring, but I could see there was something in the way she communicated that I could see she had a sensibility that I didn't have. And I wanted to get to know her. And I knew I needed to be around her somehow to sort of pick that up. And I don't know if I've told her this story, so I won't say her name, but it felt like I was just waiting for the opportunity to meet her in person. And then when I did, that was it really. She became very involved in my life. So 3 important meetings really, Dada Rinpoche, Bante, and my preceptor on that occasion. I wanted to... in a way, meeting my preceptor was really important because she was somebody who I could actually meet up with. You know, Bante, you didn't have as much access to him, and Dada had already died. So it was important that there was someone I could actually meet and get to know in person. So that was very important. And I did feel like I wanted to follow in their footsteps. I thought, I don't know where they are, you know, on the path, on the journey, but I can do, it can only be good for me to follow in their footsteps. So I think that sort of aspect of sort of being inspired by somebody's example in terms of how they live their life, I think that came easy for me because I'd always been looking out from a child for people to look up to, actually. And the first person that I really thought, I can completely look up to you, was Dr. Martin Luther King. I was just very inspired by how he held himself as a person. He had all those difficulties and struggles and challenges working in the segregated South in America. And yet he held himself with such dignity and grace, but also was able to mobilize pretty much so much of America at a very, very difficult time. So he was somebody that I was able to look up to. But obviously, we know that he died, was assassinated. So for me to meet you know, Dalai Rinpoche and others who actually lived to a very ripe old age, and, you know, had very sort of, were joyous in their practice and path was very important. So exemplification really means that. It means being an example to others. And all those people I've spoken about were really positive examples to me. I think we all have an impact on each other. We influence each other. Probably without us realizing. We probably influence each other more than we realize. I think, yeah, we probably underestimate what that is. So Bante died, as we know, last in October 31st. And I guess from then I was thinking about, I think many of us were thinking about, well, his impact on us individually and collectively. And then a month after that, my stepfather died. And that was very interesting, sort of reflecting on two very different lives. We had a wonderful funeral for my stepfather, and he'd been ill for some time, so it was sort of expected. But nonetheless, when somebody dies, it's still a huge shift, because you're having to reorientate your life somehow. You're having to take on the fact that they're no longer there, and you're having to think, well, what was their life then? You're sort of evaluating their life anew and seeing what the impact it has on you. What was lovely at the funeral was how many people spoke about his spiritual qualities. He was a very devoted man, a very committed man, and he had a lot of kindness, particularly as he got older. There was one man that I was thanking. I said, thank you so much for coming to the funeral. And he said, of course I would come. He was like a father to me. And this man didn't have, you know, his father was absent in his life. And, you know, my stepfather really took him on. Even though he had a number of other children, he took him on and really did fatherly things with him. So it had a real impact. And many of his grandchildren were the pallbearers, including my son, were the pallbearers. And you could see the pride on their faces carrying his coffin. It was very moving to see that. They were sort of sad to... they were sort of sad that he was no longer there, but they just had such pride, and they wanted to carry his coffin, and they wanted to, you know, physically dig, you know, his grave. It was very, very strong seeing that. So yes, he didn't have a spiritual practice, he had faults. He had things that caused suffering around him, but in a way, because he did. His qualities outshone his difficulties in the end. But I do think, gosh, imagine if he'd had a community. Imagine if he'd had other people who were encouraging him to really develop his qualities even further and to work on the other areas of his life that were causing difficulty. Imagine the difference of that. So exemplification means, well, first acknowledging that we have an influence on each other, and what it doesn't mean is that we have to be perfect or pretend to be other than we are, but it does mean that we practice, we keep making the effort, and we keep working to develop and cultivate our qualities, and working on the things that get us in the way, that separates us from others. Really, in a nutshell, that's what exemplification is. Sometimes we can think, you might be very inspired by that, or you might think, that sounds a bit hard, that sounds hard work, or on a good day I can exemplify, but not on a bad day. But in a way, if we remember that we're always having an influence on others, that sort of helps, I think. No matter what's going on for you, you can practice, you can decide to focus on a particular quality. So one of the things I think is helpful is to have vision, to have a sense of vision, a sort of sense of a picture of where we want to, you know, what's possible for us. I think without that vision of what's possible for us, I think making an effort can feel like hard work, yeah? So we have to have a sense of where we're moving towards. That's really important. And I think we need to use our imagination sometimes. We don't always know what's possible for us, you know, from our current experience. So if we imagine, well, imagine, just like imagining being on the tube and everyone's been practicing the Metta Bhavana. Well, imagine you've, you know, been practicing the Metta Bhavana and you're able to stay with the qualities that are evoked through the course of your day, so that whenever whatever challenges come, you're meeting it sort of positively and creatively. We can do that. Just imagination is important. So we have to have a picture of where we're going, and then we have to have a sense that we're not alone in that. So that's the thing about a spiritual community as well. The vision of where what's possible in growth is shared. You know, we're all different, so we all have a different particular vision, if you like. But coming together and knowing that everyone's moving towards a similar goal really helps us. So I was on the winter retreat recently, and there's one or two people here that was there as well. And we had this team of 13 of us running the retreat. And it was a mixed team in terms of gender, different nationalities. There were people that had been practicing for a couple of years, right up to, I think, somebody practicing for 25, 30, almost 30 years. So a real range of experience. And it was really, you know, our job really was to have, to really deepen our own practice, as well as help run this retreat, have a successful retreat. And I was very moved by the experience of being on the team, actually, because really there was exemplification going on every day, every meeting that we had. Everyone there was making an effort to practice, and they were very honest about what was going on for them. So if, you know, they had a bad day, they said they were having a bad day, but they also talked about how they were working with that. And that was, and it was very moving just hearing that level of honesty. They also acknowledged when they had made positive efforts as well, and they were sort of people were rejoicing in that. They were also rejoicing in others and saying, you know, when you did that or when you said this, it really helped me, you know, with whatever was going on. So it was a kind of, you know, exemplification was happening on lots of levels. And what was interesting as well was that I remember somebody saying that they could relate to somebody who was very near them in practice more than they could to somebody who'd been practicing for 30 years. Yeah. So in a way, it's not underestimating the effect that we have. You could see it very tangibly when one person was having a challenging day, somebody else there was being very positive and encouraging, and it would swap around. And gradually, it was like the level of our experience as a team was getting higher and higher in terms of our levels of communication and connection with each other. So yes, it's not about being perfect. It's really about just knowing that you can always make an effort, no matter what's going on in your life. So I realised on that retreat that I'd always had a sense of vision, actually, but probably there were a couple of moments in my life where I would say that, I wouldn't say I lost the vision completely, but it was dimmed, yeah? I wasn't as connected. And the first time when I was quite newly involved, I've probably been involved 2 or 3 years, and I moved to London, and I was busy working in a very good organisation, living quite far from the centre. I couldn't get here very much. I didn't know that many people either. And I just remember one day, I was meditating still, so I felt like I was still doing the right things, but I remembered one day feeling something was missing. And I couldn't sort of put my finger on what was missing. And I realised that, well, in a way, I wasn't around enough people who were showing me what happens when you practice. I was sort of practising by myself, really. And I needed to be in a context where I could see the possibilities of practice in lots of different ways. So I got more involved after that at this centre. And the second time was actually when I was ordained. So I was already ordained. In a way, I had a good sense of Sangha community by then. I had lots of practices I could do. I was very involved in, I was running an organisation that I'd founded. I was raising my son. That wasn't new. I'd sort of always been involved in working in the world. I realised after a while that I... But again, life began to feel quite narrow, and I couldn't sort of, again, put my finger on it. And I realised, again, that exemplification was a thing, was one of the things that was missing for me at that time. I learned a few things about myself and Sangha, if you like, in that time. So I'll just say what these are. I think I'd been in that situation for a while, and it had been working, you know, the, what I was doing. But a point came where it stopped working. So the first thing I realised was that as we keep growing, we change and our conditions might need to change in order to support further growth. And that somehow hadn't quite dawned on me because everything seemed to be all right on the surface. So as we change, sometimes our conditions need to change in order to continue making progress. And for me, so Sangha was the, I just wasn't around enough people and seeing, I wasn't around enough people seeing what could happen with practice, really. I just was focused too much on my own practice and things became a bit narrow. So secondly, what I learned there was that not being around enough people who are practicing, exemplifying practice, it dimmed my vision as to the nature of the path, the nature of spiritual growth itself. So the Buddha talks about the Dharma as rain, and it pours down on every being without any distinction, any discrimination. And as it pours down on every being, it affects us all very differently because we're all coming with different conditions, different sort of temperaments. And it's a bit like seeing a plant grow. You don't actually know. You do all the right things, but you don't know how a plant's going to actually grow. And it's always like amazing, you know, when that bud opens, it's like, wow, how did that happen? And you sort of know how it happened on the one hand, but it's still very sort of mysterious and beautiful and wondrous. And we're like that. You know, we're like those sort of plants. When we be receptive and open to the Dharma, we don't actually know what difference that's going to make for us. So there's a beauty in seeing that happen again and again and again, not just in ourselves, but in other people. Sometimes it's easier to see it in other people, actually. But it's easier to see, gosh, you've really changed. You know, something's different about you. On the retreat, I was doing meditation reviews, which is where you meet up with somebody to talk about their practice. And obviously, we had our team meetings. And people would say, oh, Surya Gupta, when you did that teaching on whatever it was, you said this, Surya Gupta, and I did that, and this is what happened. I'd be like, that just sounds incredible. I'd be like, I feel like we're saying, did I really say that? You know, it sounds amazing what I said. And I was thinking, why do I keep saying that? It's getting embarrassing. I'm like, that sounds really good. And I think it was because each time, I had to think about this, and well, why does that keep surprising me? How somebody's feeding back a teaching that I've actually given. I remember saying those words, and yet it sounds a bit like what you were saying earlier. Yet it sounds really interesting, and I want to even understand it more. And it was almost like I was hearing the teaching for the first time again. And I thought, why is that? And I think it's because how somebody interprets a teaching is very unique to them. What difference it makes to them, you will never know until they express it. Until they communicate it, you'll never know. So I was delighted each time that somebody said, you know, oh, this is what I did with that teaching. This is what difference it made. I just was seeing, it was like seeing a bud open up, and it was just very moving and touching. So when you're not around the Sangha very much, you sort of don't see those things happening in other people. You can be focused on your own growth, which is good, but actually you really begin to see the nature of growth more through being in contact with others. And I think the third thing I would say that I learned from that period where my sort of vision dimmed was that I was busy working, and it was very positive work. There was very lots of success was happening. But in a way, I had to rely more and more on my own spiritual strengths, my own qualities, my own spiritual strengths and qualities. And my areas to develop, if you like, my weaknesses, were left unchallenged. Or they were not challenged in a way that was positive. And I realised, I thought I could develop quite a lopsided, sort of unbalanced way, actually, if I'm relying on my strengths, but not being, there's not enough of a mirror to my areas that I need to develop. And I think you see that with really well-known famous people. You know, they're amazing. You hear about them being amazing in the public sphere. They're doing all these incredible things, but they can create all kinds of interpersonal difficulties, behind closed doors and things. And I think they don't have enough mirrors that sort of helping them to work on the areas they need to be full-rounded human beings. So exemplification works on all those levels. We have to use it with the other three qualities, which is generosity, beneficial activity, and kindly speech. And we use all those qualities for our ongoing development, but also when things go wrong. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about when things go wrong and then wrap up. So we are all different. There are barriers, in a way, what we're doing as a community is letting go of our identification with our own particular conditioning so we can connect to the common humanity and liberate ourselves from that, what that holds us back. Yeah. So, but things go wrong in that, there can be misunderstandings, conflicts, there can be disputes. And we have to remember when this happens that we're not trying to be perfect. It's not about, exemplification isn't about trying to be perfect. Because we're not perfect. There's a long way for us to grow. Actually, perfection really happens only with the Buddha, yeah? With a fully enlightened being. This side of enlightenment, we're still impacted by greed, hatred, and delusion. But what we need, before I say what we need, Bhante talks about something called the gravitational pull. There's a part of us that wants to grow, and there's a part of us that wants to stay the same. There's a part of us that wants to practice and get up every morning to meditate, and there's a part of us that wants to stay in bed. Yeah. There's a part of us that wants to connect deeply with another, with others, and there's a part of us that wants to keep ourselves separate because it feels safe to do that. So there's always these pulls. There's an urge to grow and there's a pull towards staying the same, towards shutting down, really. So, and that's actually an intrinsic part of the human condition, this tension. And the more we understand and work with ourselves, the more we understand that tension, and the more, hopefully, we can have a sort of empathic response to ourselves around that. We don't give up on ourselves. We don't say, okay, I stayed in bed today and didn't meditate, that's it. That's me done in terms of my practice. You get up and you do it the next day, So we don't give up on ourselves. We remember that there's that urge to grow. And actually, I feel that's a stronger urge in us. But we need empathy for ourselves and others. And I think the more we understand that tension and our sort of human condition, when something goes wrong, particularly if, somebody's, even in the context of the community, has done something, you think, oh, why did they do that? Why did they say that? If we approach it with that understanding of the human condition, if we approach it with empathy, we can address the issue in a much more constructive way. We're not going to go into, if we think of empathy, we remember this tension that exists in all of us, this side of enlightenment, we won't necessarily have to polarise. We can stay engaged with them. They stay engaged with us. We can let go of judgment and keep working to find the truth of the situation. So in exemplification, we can be inspired by the exemplary lives that I've mentioned and others. There's many, many people that have led exemplary lives, sort of inspirational beings, who are not necessarily perfect, but they're way on the path to enlightenment. We can remember that we influence others and be prepared to share our efforts with others, however our efforts are. And we can acknowledge and rejoice in the efforts of others to give them encouragement and to be a really positive mirror to others. So yes, I think this centre was founded really by inspiration. It was founded by living bodhisattvas. It was founded by exemplary human beings. But really, it only comes alive and stays alive with us practicing and bringing spiritual values and qualities into being every day. You know, as I said, many of these beings, we don't necessarily have lots of contact with them. Or, as I said, when I got involved, Dada Rinpoche had already died. So in a way, I sort of felt that it was an onus on me. And the same with Bhante dying. It's an onus on me to really take to heart the teachings and try to bring the qualities into being in my everyday life, knowing that I have an influence on others, whether I like it or whether I know it or not. So I would urge you this year to have that vision for yourself. You know, what is the next step for you to progress, to keep growing? And actually, how can you share your practice more? How can you be more engaged with others and listen to their practice so that we all get a sense of how sort of really wondrous the Dharma is and how it's impacting on all of our lives and making a difference in the world? Thank you.
You've been listening to the London Buddha Centre. Make sure to press the subscribe button, and then please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. It really helps other people to find us. Thank you.